Conversation about how we see ourselves and how others see us. I'm your host, Dan Harris, and for the next 45 minutes or so, we'll be asking our guests from Germany, UK, Japan, and USA about our topic of conversation today, which is Jishugu, is social responsibility the best vaccine? This is a recorded podcast, but you can send us your feedback via our website, overhereoverthere.org, or on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Social responsibility has been a critical imperative before the vaccines were developed, and it remains vital for the safety and well-being as the vaccines are rolled out across the world. But some countries have fared better since the beginning of the outbreak, and we'd like to discuss the reasons for this and what we can learn from each other across the world in true over here, over there fashion. I'm joined by my fellow podcaster, Claudia Kussler, senior editor of the Süddeutsche Zeitung in Munich. Claudia grew up in Bavaria and has lived in California, London, and Iceland, and erudite over so many issues, which is greatly appreciated on podcasts like this. I must say, Claudia, do you think there's been a unifying belief and practice in Germany of adhering to social distancing guidelines and fighting the pandemic? What's happened with this process? I know that there has been some issues and some protests, but certainly not like in other countries.
You're quite right in saying that. Hello to everyone. Well, generally speaking, yes, most people here in Germany followed the guidelines, but very reluctantly. There was always a bit of doubt about every measure. And overall, there is also a very strong tendency noticeable to stretch the guidelines or even push them a little bit further. People tend to sound out the possibilities with them, you know, trying to get a smidge closer than the 1.5 meters or putting your mask on, but just not right over the nose, or start a conversation referring to a mask like it's being a gag or a muzzle, and sniff out the other person if he or she agrees, and then you can take it further. So yeah, people followed the guidelines, but as I said, reluctantly.
Well, let's bring in our panel. First on the list is Mike Bellissimo, who's comes from outside of Boston, Massachusetts this morning, whose career has taken him from senior positions in the high-tech world at the likes of Apple Computers, Sun Microsystems, Yahoo, Microsoft, then into the world of healthcare management in senior posts at Humana and the renowned Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. And after all that, Mike is now doing a doctorate in healthcare sustainability at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, which we'll ask him about shortly. We are delighted also to have psychotherapist Margaret Cavanaugh, based in the UK, specializing in cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, and has seen the mental impact of the pandemic on her patients. Margaret can speak about the change of behaviors and government policies that is needed to support the well-being of her patients, their families, and the wider community. We also welcome Kaki Okumura, who is a top Japanese writer in food, cooking, health, travel, and culture, joining us from Tokyo. She can be found on her website, kakikata.space. She is also a Japanese-American who wrote the opinion piece in Yes Magazine entitled Pandemic Lessons from Japan, a tradition of considering others that sparked this discussion. So welcome and thank you all for being virtually over here and over there. The COVID pandemic has been devastating in so many ways. Each country has its own unique story in the management of the pandemic, all with different strengths and weaknesses. There are some that have managed to take it in their stride a bit more than others, keeping it relatively, under control, although furiously vigilant to each potential outbreak. Japan, with the third largest economy, is one of these countries. The data behind transmitted cases shows Japan with approximately 1% of cases and deaths relative to the United States. How has Japan maintained control and achieved relative success? We'll ask Kaki what we can learn and possibly use in some other ways in other countries. The U.S., with highly trained healthcare professionals and world-leading medical facilities, has had challenges encouraging more socially responsible behaviors. One of these is mask wearing, which became a highly politicized issue in the U.S., causing CDC Director Robert Redfield to make this statement to Congress. He said, and I quote, "We are not defenseless against COVID-19. Cloth face coverings are one of the most powerful weapons we have to slow and stop the spread of the virus, particularly when used universally within a community setting. All Americans have a responsibility to protect themselves, their families, and their communities. This is just one example, but we'll look at others to see how countries approach different problems and what can be learned and adapted from them. Kaki, can you give us an impression about the meaning of jishuku?
Yeah, of course. I first heard the term or learned of the term jishuku sometime March 2011, which was right after the Great Tohoku earthquake. In general, jishuku is loosely defined as a practice of restraining from fun, luxury, and celebration in consideration of others who are also going through a hard time. This term, jishuku, came up because the Prime Minister of Japan at the time encouraged individuals to stay inside, and it was a way for people to show support to those directly affected. Not just support for the victims, but also for the volunteers and the workers as well. And the idea of jishuku is that if you can't directly help, you should at least show some camaraderie for those who are working outside and trying to save lives.
And how widely is it followed or accepted?
Yeah, I think especially if you... I think in general, there aren't large protests, not in the sense like in the United States where they're anti-maskers. But I do think on the large parts, the virus has been really difficult on people who are in the restaurant industry or entertainment industry. And I know in the beginning, there's really no protest against jishuku, but it's been about a year now. And so I know a lot of people are getting impatient with it. But I'd say on the whole, you wouldn't see the kind of protests or the kind of pushback that you've seen right in the United States.
Mike, are you finding in your research that hospitals are being impacted, particularly in certain states, because of lack of adherence to social guidelines? I'm not sure if you can tell us at this point in your research, but you know, what are the factors are you finding so far?
Yeah, Dan, thanks for the question. So if anyone out there listening is a researcher, you can relate to the comment I'm going to make, which is I have the opportunity to research during what we would call a natural experiment. And it's an unfortunate natural experiment, which is the pandemic. I had no intent to research during a pandemic. My research actually started before the pandemic, but as a result, it shifted. And I talked to 30 top CEOs and chief executives of hospitals across the United States starting in April. So I've been tracking with them since late 2020 to understand how they're being impacted by the pandemic. And of course, as we all see on the news, hospitals have been overrun. An interesting statistic is that the United States has about the same number of hospital beds as Japan, and Japan's about one third the size of the United States. So that in and of itself can tell you a little bit about, you know, some of the disparities you might see if you compare country to country. And so during the first wave, we all saw certain cities impacted more than others. New York City really was the beginning of this for us back in the late winter, early spring. My daughter was on the front lines then working at a hospital in New York City. And so, you know, we can speak firsthand about her experience as a nurse practitioner on the front lines and how it affected her both physically as well as mentally as a frontline caregiver. So, you know, first and foremost, what the hospital leaders were telling me is that not only were they challenged with the lack of inventory, PPE, as we've heard, but also the effect on their staff. They were being asked to do what I would call Herculean work. They were working, you know, multiple shifts, you know, 24 hours. There just wasn't enough, you know, staff to just deal with this onslaught. Interestingly, cities like San Francisco, where you and I used to live, handled the initial wave a lot better. They have a lot of muscle memory from the AIDS pandemic back in the 80s and 90s. And what they learned was how to deal with these sort of matters beyond just the natural disasters they deal with. But the big, big factor that has affected hospitals in a positive way has been the learning that they've gained around collaboration. Once they figured out that this was a pandemic they couldn't handle on their own, that they had to collaborate and cooperate and communicate with each other, meaning share things like inventory, PPE, who's got more or less of masks or booties or head coverings. I mean, that literally would have never happened before. But beyond that, they were sharing ICU bed occupancy. They were sharing with each other data that they would never share before because, at least in the U.S., hospitals in a certain city like Philadelphia, where I interviewed all the hospital executives, they saw each other as competitors. So a big learning coming out of this and what's happened during the second wave is they learned how to cooperate, how to work together, how to share resources. They were literally sharing doctors and nurses, paying for them. You know, where were the patients? And so while the second surge in many ways has been worse than the first, our ability to respond to it has been better. Now, that said, you know, if you follow California, it's probably the worst case now for us because just about all ICU beds are occupied. We just don't have enough inventory of hospital beds to deal with the surge in the virus. So I would say that a lot of learning has happened as a result of this. And so maybe the silver lining will be that, you know, should something like this happen again, you know, we'll be better prepared.
Well, thanks a lot. Margaret, would the government or media pundits say that social interactions during the pandemic should be left up to, I heard this so often over here, like sensible common sense or sensible individuals or common sense, use your common sense. So just how bedded in are these social norms that we're trying to adapt like Japan does with Jushiku in both the UK and Germany? But I'll start with Margaret first.
Hi. Well, it's really interesting reading this article because my thought was that actually in the UK, we have a tradition of social responsibility. If you go back to the Second World War, where everybody pulled together, and in a way, that was taken apart when Thatcher was saying there's no such thing as responsibility, there's no such thing as society. And I just wonder whether now that there's this underlying thing of British people are quite social, they want to conform, they want to do the right thing, and yet they're told it's your common sense. And actually, everybody's idea of common sense is different. So some of my clients were going, actually, because I don't know what to do, I so want to not do the wrong thing, I'll just stay indoors. And there's a massive uprise in things like agoraphobia because they don't want to go out and accidentally break a rule because they don't know what the rules are. So when you say common sense, that means that puts responsibility on the individual. And I think on one level, there's this dissonance. The government is all about individual responsibility. But I wonder whether there is such thing as society and people in the UK want to conform and they want to be told exactly what the right thing to do is. And this is why a lot of people say in the first lockdown, things were much simpler because we knew exactly what to do. It wasn't my responsibility to not kill somebody by refusing to wear a mask. So just in my town, which is a small town in the middle of England, there's a really high uptake of mask wearing. You know, I find people are not worried about, they want to know what the right thing to do is. And so there's an embarrassment around, should I wear a mask outside or should I wear a mask outside or not? But when they're told in a shop, wear a mask, people conform to that. So I think people actually want to know what the right thing to do is, so they can do the right thing. And I think there is this idea of, you know, jishuku, whatever it's called. There is a set, that sentiment would be shared in the UK, although it's not formalised. And I don't think the government quite realises how people really want to do the right thing and are conforming when they know what it is.
The UK during the war and after post-war for a while had that then we went through the 60s and 70s, probably lost that a bit.
And you, well, I think it's more the 80s, it's Thatcherism, yeah.
Now we're just relearning it, aren't we?
Yeah, I wonder whether there is some of that about, because certainly with the people that I see in therapy and also in my life, people want to do the right thing and they want to help others and they want to support the NHS and stop the spread. But they don't want to have the responsibility of deciding what that right thing is. They don't have the information, you know, and actually that just raises anxiety of use your common sense. Well, I don't have the facts to hand, you know, and we want instruction. A lot of people just want clear guidelines.
Claudia?
I think that is very interesting what Margaret just said, because in a way I can relate to that when I see my country's people here. And in some parts, we are totally different. Because when I think about social responsibility or restraining yourself, there isn't really a German word for it. So when I think about it, the closest word for it might be some sort of discipline. And that is a something my country is quite known for. It goes hand in hand with efficiency and doing the right thing in a way, you know, but it's always referred to work discipline in a way and not to a society. When it comes to responsibilities within a society, it is a different story here. And discipline here is sometimes seen as something at least ambiguous, maybe something bad even. And that might have has a lot to do with my nation's history, where obedience has led to a catastrophe and a world on fire. So for generations after World War II, obedience was seen as a kind of root of evil, or at least a possibility for evil things, and something to avoid at almost all costs, at least in an overall context. And what was left was discipline when it comes to work and doing things right there. And this is how you gain back some sort of respect, or you shield yourself, you make yourself secure. But socially, there has been a very strong resistance to conformity. And now things have to change. And there are interventions from a state into the private lives of people that have not been seen for a long time. All of a sudden, masks were mandatory, your contacts were limited. Now even your possibilities to go around freely are restricted. So this has provoked a lot of disagreements and questions, and people are insecure what the right thing is. And people sometimes fail to see the necessity of it in order to save lives, because maybe they haven't seen serious cases in their personal surroundings and they don't understand the necessity. People are used to their personal freedom here, and this is hard to change, especially when you also consider that large parts of Germany were under a totalitarian regime. So this country as a whole has not yet gained a stable position in a way for a long time. And the measures that are now taken stir those columns, you know, which were rarely built. It is ambiguous in a way.
Thank you. Yeah. Kaki, I'd just like to ask, Japan had like a running start. It was sort of other things besides mask wearing to fighting the virus, but we'll just use that because it has been quite politicized in certain countries. But it's something that's been bedded in already in Japan. So you were already ready for this pandemic and what you had to do. So sort of like a standing start. So the political nature of it sort of was, the sting was taken out of it, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, even if it's not someone who's sick, if you have allergies and you're sneezing, it just seemed like the polite thing to do to wear a mask. It wasn't just for other or for yourself, but wearing a mask was really just something for other people. And, you know, before Corona, I didn't really think about this a lot, but, you know, for someone who is coughing or slightly sick or sneezing to not be wearing a mask, it was kind of thought of as rude and you weren't being considerate of others. And so as soon as Corona came in and the government says, hey guys, wear masks, it was really not even a question. People are like, oh, okay, this is the polite thing to do to, you know, be considerate of others.
Do you think that the Japanese government or maybe even Japanese society on the whole, we in the West think, Japanese or Asian countries, they conform more, you know, to the rule of law, they conform more to social norms than we do. But with the concept of jishoku, you say that's also liberating at the same time, because you're in very considerate and very compassionate to be able to think about others as well. So do you think it's the criticism of that sort of stereotype is fair or not?
I think the criticism is completely fair. There are pros and cons to conforming to societal norms, and it's not all great. It's just been a really powerful advantage to have during the age of Corona and just during this pandemic. But I think something that this pandemic has maybe shown is how societal norms can actually protect personal freedom, which kind of might seem counterintuitive, but because so many people are willing to exercise restraint and responsibility on the societal level, the government didn't actually have to intervene as much. On a whole, Japanese people are able to leave the house and they had a choice without being fined or arrested for it. There are no government issued tracking bracelets or fines for being out on a whole, I felt that in a weird way, I had a lot more freedom than I would have had in the United States, where there are strict lockdowns and you, by law, weren't allowed to leave the house. You know, that's kind of, it seems counterintuitive, but I think it's an interesting thing to have experienced, where because these societal norms existed, I actually had a lot more freedom in the way I lived my daily life.
Mike, do you think the U.S. is too divided to unify successfully around a culture of social responsibility like in Japan or other Asian countries?
Sure. Well, you know, I love hearing this conversation because it's important that we get different perspectives. I've spent a ton of time working and living in Japan and in Europe. And, you know, if I were watching the BBC or NHK, which I watch almost every day, I would be horrified about what I was seeing going on in the United States. And so, you know, because the news media, you know, of course, likes to promote what's most sensational. That said, you know, it's been a challenge here. First of all, let's all understand this is a highly transmissible disease. And in fact, the second wave has proven that it's even more transmissible than the first. Secondly, most people who are infected are asymptomatic. They don't even know that they're sick. So you're telling somebody who's like feeling well and being well to, you know, to stay home. Literally, I think I've been home for almost a year now with little travel. You know, in the United States, you know, Dr. Anthony Fauci, who I have the esteemed pleasure of having gone to the same high school as he, a Jesuit high school. And if anyone's familiar with the Jesuits, you know, we're taught at a very early age how to be socially responsible and to care for others. It's sort of embedded in that upbringing. So, you know, if you listen to that Dr. Anthony Fauci as opposed to Redfield, you know, you would hear that, you know, we should be wearing masks all the time. We should be socially distanced. You know, but what happened in the United States is the pandemic became instantly politicized by the current, you know, federal government. And that changed everything, right? We didn't have good examples from the top telling us what to do. And I didn't need to be told what to do. I think probably no one on this call would have needed to be told what to do. We knew what to do. But for the most part, if you come from a privileged background, which I think we all do, you know, I can afford to stay home. I can afford to work from home. I can afford to do my research from home. You know, most people in the United States couldn't do that. Most people here are blue collar workers. You know, they're paid hourly. You know, their jobs and their livelihoods are on the line, living paycheck to paycheck. Their healthcare is connected to their work. And so how do you tell people like that not to go to work, not to be outside? How do you tell families who've got little kids who are now home from school, you know, how to stay home with your kids that, you know, that they don't have a lifeline? So I think the big challenge has been in the United States. It's really laid bare the inequities in our healthcare system. We've disinvested in community health. We've disinvested in public health. Many people have comorbidities. So if they get the virus, they're more likely to get sick and be in the hospital than a more privileged, you know, person would be. And so I think it's as with all things, I wish it was as simple as be socially responsible, wear a mask. You know, the last thing I'll say is, having traveled all over the world, you know, what I've learned about human nature and humans is we are actually very socially responsible people as a human, as a race. We, you know, we care for each other. We do care about each other. I've seen more similarities and differences, you know, being and living across the world, but it's the examples that are set for us by, in this case, political leaders that really set the tone for how we react. And in the case of Japan, the tone that was set by Abe, you know, was very much aligned with the Japanese culture. In Europe, the tone that was set by Boris Johnson was very different than the tone that was set by Angela Merkel. And so I think at the end of the day, you know, tone at the top really, really matters and really, really mattered in this pandemic.
Yes, it's unfortunate. I mean, you know, various countries, you know, with responses, it wasn't quite unified. And you'd wonder, even with a strong America or a clear leadership at the top, would they have been able to, you know, guide the rest of the world? Because it's been turned out to be quite, you know, an individual approach, hasn't it? You know, it seems like, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like more the institutions, the hospitals have been, and the professionals have been talking to each other more so than the politicians.
That's right. You know, where I live, the politically elected folks have been almost ineffective in their ability to control anything. Whereas the healthcare workers, the healthcare leaders have been the ones that have been the best able to, maybe that's a learning. Maybe, you know, I mean, we've all said from the beginning, we need to listen to the science. We need to listen to the scientists. We need to listen to the experts. And when healthcare is politicized, you know, you get the result that you see.
Claudia, would you like to come in on something?
I would like to ask each of you here on the panel a question, because I think we now all agree that what you do as an individual affects others. And we all agree that you have to use common sense when it comes to the pandemic, to be considerate of others. But what do you do if you have that response not within your opponent? Opponent might be the wrong word, but if you be in a situation where you are considerate of others, but others are not to you. Let me give you an example. Yesterday night, I was out grocery shopping, and we are in a very strict lockdown, so you're not allowed to mingle with more than one person from another household. And on the parking lot, I encountered a group of people having a party, had a music box in the trunk of their car, having beer, standing very closely together without any masks. And I had to pass them to come to go to my shop. And I was in a total pickle. Shall I say something to them? Shall I remind them of the lockdown rules and measures? Or shall I just go along and mind my own business? It's one thing to think about what I do or what my family does. But how about my responsibility towards the society when I see things not working out? Shall I take that on?
Margaret, do you want to take that?
Well, I think that's really, it's a great question. And I get that a lot. But my view is one of the beauty of the rules is if the vast majority of people abide by them, that's enough. There's always going to be people who do not abide by the social norms. There's always going to be a fringe, right? In the UK, most people want to wear masks. There's always going to be some that don't. But as long as enough of us do, then that's good enough. So in my view, it's let's do the best we can. And there's always going to be people who, and I sort of agree with what Mike said. Often it's because they can't afford to, or they're not, don't have the education, or, you know, they've been stuck in a one bed flat with three children and they just have to get out. So unless, you know, we can't really know exactly what's going on in somebody else's life. And I think in those sort of situations, my view is we have to be a bit more understanding. Most people want to do the right thing. And when they're not, there could be many mitigating reasons for that. I don't know what the others think.
Kaki, what would be the reaction if you came across someone like Claudia describes, some people not abiding by the social guidelines, Dishiku, we've been discussing? What would your reaction be?
It's a hard situation. And my personal reaction would probably be more towards the ignoring side, just because I feel as though people know, they've already heard, wear your mask, keep distance, don't hang out in big groups. People already know that advice. It's not that they've never heard it. And reminding someone of that doesn't necessarily make them think, oh, this isn't a good thing, but it'll just antagonize them. And I think, like Margaret said, there's always going to be some people who don't want to abide by the rules. And sometimes they have good reasons for it. They're really lonely at home. They need to go out because of work. I mean, watching a party, you can kind of understand that that's not necessarily something you need to do. And it's really frustrating to come across. But I think it really is that if enough people do it, then that is enough. And so coming across a situation like that, it might feel like being irresponsible, not speaking up. And I guess it could go both ways. I think it'd be wonderful if someone would speak up. But personally, I think it wouldn't be the most effective form of convincing someone to practice more self-restraint.
Mike, I'm very interested to hear if you've had any incidents or situation where you've run across and felt obligated or just wanted to say something or not. Or have you seen anything that has just been beyond the pale or something in your area in the Northeast?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, there's an offset saying that you can't legislate common sense, right? You can't legislate people to do the right thing. It has to sort of be inherent in them. And that's normally okay in society when people are not in positions of power, right? So you could argue that some of our leaders haven't exercised common sense. In fact, they haven't exercised common sense. I mean, I don't want to give examples. There are plenty of them, and we know what they are. But now everybody's walking around with the potential to have this deadly disease that they can transmit to somebody else. So, you know, it's a different kind of situation. We're all sort of weaponized, potentially not even knowing it, right? So we're learning the fact that, you know, we could do harm to somebody else and we don't even realize it. So I adhere to Margaret's, you know, way of thinking, which is, and I'll just say, you know, the idea of being kind, right? So how do you be kind, right? You know, you're out there wearing a mask, you know, in my case, going to the supermarket and you see somebody without a mask. In our supermarkets, you have to walk down one aisle and walk down another. Basically, these were things that were put in place to try to prevent people from congregating. I mean, this is all new for a lot of people. And so, you know, the tendency is when you're walking down an aisle and you see somebody walking down incorrectly to get mad at them or angry or, you know, point out their, you know, I mean, who knows what they're dealing with? Who knows who they are, right? Could they be a senior or somebody with some other impairment? You know, maybe they don't care, but you know, more often than not, people don't. So the idea of being kind. And so, you know, what I typically do is, and you can see somebody smile even through their eyes. You know, I try to smile and look at them, and maybe I'll even kind of do a circle around my mask to remind them, hey, you know, you need to wear a mask, or you know, do a little kind of, hey, social distance with my arms. We all want to get angry with people who aren't conforming because we feel like we are, but you know, what I've learned how to do is to try to be kind, because most people, I think, do want to do the right thing. I think someone said earlier, there's this fringe that just won't, no matter what. And those are folks you really can't engage with. And probably, like Kaki said, they're probably not worth engaging with. They're not going to listen to you. But most people want to do the right thing. And so, so I'd say, you know, if we all learn from this, what can we learn from this, right? There's a lot we can learn from this. And books will be written about this pandemic. You know, we'll tell our grandchildren about our experience. You know, I have all this great research I'll be able to publish. But at the end of the day, you know, hopefully one big learning is going to be, you know, there's a lot that comes from kindness and just being caring about each other. And if that means wearing a mask, social distancing, you know, then that's a good thing.
You're listening to Over Here, Over There, and I'm your host, Dan Harris, with fellow podcaster Claudia Kussler, senior editor of the Süddeutsche Zeitung, and our guest, senior healthcare and high-tech executive Mike Bellissimo, who you just heard there, psychotherapist Margaret Kavanaugh, and Japanese writer Kaki Okamura.
And we're discussing Jishigu. Is social responsibility the best vaccine?
Margaret, when you follow and do the social responsibility, there are costs that isn't easy. Just from your practice and what you observe as far as the mental strain and the mental well-being, what kind of toll it's taking on what you've heard from your patients and clinics and others?
Well, actually, it's quite interesting. From what we were just talking about, Claudia, you were saying, I spotted this group of people having a party. And I think what happens is we look for danger. So we're focusing on that and we don't spot the 100,000 people that we've passed who are all abiding by the rules. And it's human nature to spot the danger. Oh, there's somebody not wearing a mask. So we might be in a supermarket, everybody's wearing masks apart from one person, and that's the one we'll focus on. So I think in terms of general mental health, what happens is we start focusing on the negative and we don't see that actually most people want to be kind. Most people want to think, be considerate and think of others. And I think that is very poor for our mental health, although it's a natural human response to do that. So I think generally people can focus on the danger, and there is a lot of danger out there, but that can become bigger in our minds. And I think generally for mental health, if we're focusing on the negative, sometimes what I try and do with my clients is say, okay, what else is there that's good? What else, you know? And this is where things like gratitude journals, really trying to force your attention away from the one person not wearing a mask onto all these wonderful acts of kindness that are going on all the time. And these people who are sacrificing so much for us. And I think sometimes that's really important. And I think the government could help with that. The newspapers, you know, we could all try to make this conscious effort to go away from where we're naturally focusing, which is on danger, and pull our focus back to so much good that is happening in this pandemic.
Kaki, how is the stress level, or how are people coping in Japan?
I think, you know, in the beginning, people are pretty okay with, you know, self-restraint and staying inside. But once it kind of, the people realize like, oh, if I wear a mask and I keep my distance in general, it's okay if I meet my friends or go someplace. And then people became very lax. And I think after people became more relaxed, and then they saw, even after that, the numbers were going up, it's hard to kind of go back to restraining again, just because there's no end in sight. I think a lot of people were expecting it to end or become, get under control a lot faster than, you know, over a year. And so people are getting a bit impatient. And I think, especially if it's something that's not just a luxury, but it's something related to your livelihood, or if you live alone, it's really rough. Many people in Japan do. And so I do think people are getting a little frustrated, but this is more in terms of protocols with shorter working hours or a limited number of patrons in restaurants or limiting alcohol sales and shops being closed or parks being closed. But wearing a mask and keeping general distance from other people, I don't think many people are opposed to that.
Claudia and Mike, I just want to ask, you know, I feel like we're at a tipping point across the world, but you know, we see the vaccines being rolled out, which is great. So we do see light at the end of the tunnel, but we're also with this virulent strain that is now accelerating. Are we at a tipping point as far as, again, going back to the mental health or just to be able to hang in there in Germany or in the States, especially in the States, Mike, which I'll come to you in a second, but with the political situation, the protests and what's happening and the transitions and all that. But I'll just go to Claudia first as far as Germany is concerned.
I definitely hope that we are on a turning point. If we had spoken maybe in October or November, I would have definitely said this is true, because we had this hope for the vaccine, which was promised in the new year or in the early spring. And everyone was very hopeful, and that helped us through autumn and the winter time in a way. At the present moment, this has ebbed up in a way, because we have in Germany, we have a big problem with rolling out the vaccine at the moment or obtaining enough vaccine. So there are no deadlines, and no one is really sure if this will take half a year or a year. So people are no longer as hopeful and happy, but it's a bit on our side, like it's straining out, it's stressful, and how long does it take? And you kind of need a focus point, you know, something positive to look out for. And once this is not determined, it's a bit stressful for some people. So at the moment, people are tending to think that this is just taking forever, and you don't see the light at the end of the tunnel in a way, also knowing that there will be an end to it all, hopefully. But then again, you never know if there will be a new mutant version of it, or there will be another virus coming. So they are a bit thin-skinned in a way, you could say. But overall, yes, there is the hope for a turning point. And I hope that my nation, my country, will have learned a lot from it, especially when it comes to consider others more, being a bit less egocentrical and thinking more unity, as a nation, as a society, and that we are all in this together, whether it's a county, a country, or the world, and that we have to find a common ground to deal with such problems.
Sounds like Jishiku concept, which we began the conversation with. Mike, the United States seems like it's always on a knife edge for the last 4 or 5 years, and we're still there. Again, talking about the mental well-being and the strain and the coping mechanisms that people use, you know, where is the United States heads at the moment? That sounds like a crazy question, but, you know, just where's the temperature, both politically and socially?
Yeah, I'm building off of what everybody else has said. You know, much like Margaret said, you know, we're wired to see danger. We're also wired for human interaction. It's really, really hard as humans to not interact with other people. I mean, it's rare that we're faced with a situation. In fact, in most of our lives, we've never been faced with a situation where we haven't been able to interact with anyone else except our loved ones. And even then, rarely. It's hard. It's really, really hard. The other thing that's always sobering for me is, you know, we're experiencing a 9/11 every day in the United States now. Over 3,000 people are dying every day. I mean, that just gives me chills to say, I want to cry when I think about that. I mean, we all remember where we were on 9/11. We all remember how we reacted. We all remember how the world came together. But it's been every day. It is physically, emotionally, mentally, it's exhausting. It's exhausting to realize that that's what's happening to people we care about, people we love, even people we don't know. Again, back to the fact that we really are wired to be empathetic for each other. So what I would say is it's hard. And the mental toll it's taking on people, I think, is only going to be realized after this is over in terms of, you know, what needs to be done. So, you know, the vaccine is rolling out now, right? We're hopeful. We should be hopeful. You know, it's a remarkable thing as a human race that we were able to produce vaccines all around the world within a year. And that only came about as a result of a lot of cooperation, a lot of collaboration, a lot of sharing of data. Again, things that probably would not have happened before. I'm hopeful for that. But, you know, we're all highly educated people on this podcast. And, you know, for the majority of the world, certainly the majority of Americans, they don't know this. They don't know this is going on because all they're hearing is the nonsense and the noise. And that's pretty disturbing to me at the end of the day. What I would say about the vaccine is, if we haven't learned anything as a result of the virus, it's how we behave during vaccine administration, right? At the end of the day, there's going to be a protocol for how it's delivered. You know, my daughter got her first jab the day after Christmas. We were overjoyed. We couldn't believe it. We were so excited. And that really was all that mattered to me, to know that my frontline daughter was taken care of. You know, I can wait. You know, I'm a healthy, middle-aged guy. You know, if I'm at the end of the line, you know, of 300 million people, I'm perfectly fine with that. And folks are going to need to be perfectly fine with that, because we're not going to all be able to get vaccinated at once, which means we need to continue to do all the things we started this podcast with. We still need to be socially responsible. We still need to wear masks. We still need to social distance until hopefully a year from now, you know, this is behind us. And yet we're seeing bad behavior. We're seeing poor behavior. Just yesterday, I saw an article written about wealthy people in Manhattan calling their concierge doctors about how they could get the vaccine first. I mean, who are these people? What do they think? What right do they think they have? What privilege do they think they have? They're afforded so much wealth in the United States. Give that money to a place that needs it to help people get cared for before you. So, you know, hopefully, you know, and I would expose that, hopefully we're going to learn that, you know, we can't continue to behave the way we were before. I'm very optimistic. You know, there's always going to be these fringe people that think they, you know, they're more privileged than others. But at the end of the day, you know, I think we're going to see people do the right thing over the course of the year. And hopefully we'll be out of this sooner than later.
We have, you know, in the industrialized world, you know, we're talking about rolling out the vaccines. What about in the developing world? And will this concept of community, Jishiku, this is the type of variant which is actually accelerating, that you've got to take care of it everywhere. Do you think that concept of Jishiku would extend, or can it extend? Are we capable of looking at others outside our own countries?
Can I intervene here? I think it already has. As I understand it, I think one of them, I think the Oxford vaccine, they forewent the patent in order that it could be sent. And one of the things they said, in order for this to be finished, it has to be allowed, so many doses have to go to the third world. Now, I don't know the detail on that, but I think that because all these vaccines have been built by cooperation, international cooperation, people sharing information, I think it was the Oxford vaccine, they specified that they would only finish it if so many doses went to the third world, and they forewent the patent. Now, I might be wrong on that. I don't know if anybody else knows anything about that, but I think that's really optimistic.
Kaki, what can you tell us about other Asian countries?
Don't quote me on this, but I read something interesting about something going on in India where I think the number of people who are getting infected went down by a quarter because a lot more people were wearing masks. And, you know, they're a lot more dense than the United States, and there's just so many more people, and they don't necessarily have the same kind of facilities that they have in Japan or the US. But the number of deaths, the number of people getting the virus went down drastically, and they credited a lot more people wearing masks. And so I do think that people are starting to become more aware of just the power of the majority taking care and looking after each other, it's really effective. And so I'm pretty hopeful that this kind of knowledge will spread to other countries as well.
Last word from anybody?
Well, just to add that we're going to see an acceleration of vaccine distribution, hopefully very, very soon. We're already starting to see it. I believe that Margaret was right about the Oxford vaccine. I think all of the Pfizer, AstraZeneca, Moderna have all reserved a certain amount of vaccine for non-developed countries. I've seen many, many foundations. The Gates Foundation is known very well for, how it's done vaccinations for other diseases across the world, use funding to secure vaccinations to help other countries. And so I think we're starting to see that. I'd like to see a lot more of it. I'd like to at least hear about it more in the news. I'd like to read about it more, where other countries are getting access to more vaccine. And so I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that that's happening. I know that all the major manufacturers, as been said, are, have that in their distribution plan. And we're not going to see hoarding. We're not going to see one country hoarding vaccine just for its citizens in the interest of, social responsibility, which is really a global need. Hopefully, one of the things that we're going to end with is this idea that social responsibility needs to be a global effort now. I think, we can talk about each of our countries, but what we've learned from the pandemic is somebody can get sick in Wuhan and in a week, somebody is sick in the United States. A variant could appear in the UK and a week later it can appear in the United States. And so social responsibility really is borderless now. It always has been. Global warming certainly has pointed that out, but hopefully we're learning that with the pandemic, health and healthcare and our health as a human race is a global social need, and it needs to be globally socially responsible.
That's a great thought to leave with. And thanks very much. And just leaves me to say many, many thanks for a great discussion here today. I want to thank Claudia Kussler, Mike Bellissimo, Margaret Kavanaugh, and Kaki Okamura. Before we close, we'd like to remind our listeners that they can subscribe to our podcast by the button below. Over here, over there, can be found on most major podcast platforms. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And today's podcast show notes can be found on our website, overhereoverthere.org. If you want to be a patron, we have a button for that too on our website, and we very much appreciate your support. And polite, insightful, humorous, and constructive comments are always welcome in any language. So please be in touch. Check out our website for our next Unmissable podcast. And until then, thank you for listening to Over Here, Over There.